All right. Good morning. Five weeks in a row now. We're on a new streak here. Thank you, Roger. Thank you for leading us in worship this morning. Thank you to Rock and Bernie who are in the back working with sound. I don't know, some mornings when you come in and the way you think things are going to be with the sound aren't the way they really should be, and so there's feedback, and then you can't find a microphone, and all those sorts of things, but makes me really appreciate a team that comes together, and we're good there. Thanks to Dave back there ushering, and Phil, you were greeting, I don't know who else, you were visiting with one another. Just feels really good to be back together. This is far different than standing in my office and week after week talking to four walls, and it's just not the same. And so I really thankful that we can be together and be in one another's presence and invite the Holy Spirit to come and be with us as well. Before we jump in this morning, let me go ahead and dismiss. If you are one of these two children sitting up here, so excited that you're both here on the same Sunday for the first time in probably over a year. Yay. You are dismissed, released, free. We will clap you on out. Hope's out there waiting for you. And you want a hug? I can give hugs. I can give you a wave from distance. There we go. A high five, air high five. Okay, very good. We'll have a good time, girls. Speaking of young ones, Chris Bennett texted with me last night and they were going to be here, but then his mother-in-law is back in the hospital for the third time in the last week. So keep the Bennett family in prayer as you go into today and into the week. It seemed like it wasn't too serious when she was in a few days ago. But, I don't have any details other than he just texted me this morning so that they weren't going to be here, that they were getting her to the hospital. So, but with that, let me invite us today. We're going to do something crazy, and we're going to turn in our Bibles to 2 Corinthians. What is this ancient letter that we began working our way through all the way back in January, all the way back before we transitioned into the Easter season, all the way back before we actually were meeting face to face. And so 2 Corinthians, if you're grabbing a Pew Bible, page 817 is going to be helpful. The words, of course, will be on the screen. Thank you to Bernie for that. Thank you to Rock that you can hear me. And so 2 Corinthians, as we really, for today and in the coming days, and I'm going to do probably 2 Corinthians a little bit different than I've done others. In fact, next week we may jump more toward the end of the letter and then maybe come back. But continuing our journey down the sidewalk of life, right? The sidewalk. Remember Curtis Lyons, the poet, right? If these sidewalks could talk, what would they tell you? If these sidewalks could talk, what would they say? This idea that the sidewalk is a symbol, right? It's a kind of a gathering up of our common experience, a bringing together our common experience and all of the joys and all of the sorrows. Right, and we can think of the beauty and the wonder and the awe and the delight, all of it kind of wrapped up with the ache and the loss, with the brokenness and the despair. And Paul, I think much like you and me, much like is true for us, Paul, he takes hold of that whole sort of experience. He feels it all in the midst of some really good relationships, and he has many of those, and in the midst of some really messy ones. And not only with that, but recognizing that even the good relationships can often go all kinds of sideways, right? Where our differences become disagreements, and our disagreements then become divisions. And oftentimes with division then comes devastation, right? And Paul steps into the midst of that, right? And in chapter 1 and verse 12 here, We read what is a truly profound statement about how we are to do life in relationships, about how we are to go about doing life, and about how we are to be living in relationship together, right? Paul steps into this. He gives us, I would say, a lens, a paradigm, a model, an example. This one verse kind of wrapping up the whole of our sidewalk experience. Keeping in mind Paul's first visit, you might remember this from back in 1 Corinthians, but Paul's first visit to Corinth was a long one. We think it was somewhere around the period of about 18 months. It was probably the longest he stayed in any of the places he went to visit. But the point behind that is that Paul lived in relationship. He did life with these people. Right? They did life together, blood, sweat, and tears. They experienced the joys and the tenderness, as well as all of the challenges and the struggles. And it's into all of that Paul writes here at verse 12. Paul speaks into that. Verse 12, he writes this. He says, "Now this is our boast." Now, boast is a loaded word. And I think we'll talk more about it maybe next week or in the weeks to come. I'm not going to kind of stay there today, but boast is a loaded word. And Paul writes in, and mostly because of the context into which he is speaking, which we'll see some of that today, but he says, "Now this is our boast," or that can be translated, "Now this is our reason." This is the reason for our boast. Here is the reason for what it is that I want to say to you. Here is the focus of my life and my heart. Here's the centrality of my thoughts. He says, "Our conscience testifies that we have conducted ourselves in the world, and especially in our relations with you, Corinthians," he says, "with integrity and godly sincerity." In effect, he says, you know, in our actions and in our attitudes with you, we are open and honest. We are genuine, and in all of my attitudes and actions, right? Genuine and authentic here, and here is this line, right? So central to the whole of our relationships here and now and with those in Corinth. And in fact, if you've been here for any length of time, we've gone over this. But I'm repeating it again because Paul repeats it. Paul continues to dive into this sort of paradigm for life. It's the culture in which he is swimming. And he writes, "In all of our doing life together," right? "In all of our attitudes and actions, we have done so relying not on worldly wisdom." And again, you may remember that is Sophia in the Greek. Sophia. "Not on worldly wisdom," he says, "but on God's grace." On Haris. And so in effect here, Paul lays out the entirety of his life. And all of his going out and all of his coming in all of his journey down the sidewalk of life, at whatever point along the sidewalk he is at this particular moment, he says, and it's not just out there, but he says it's right here and right now in the midst of my relationships with you, Corinthians, in all of my attitudes and actions, it's not the way of worldly wisdom. Not at all. It's not Sophia. It's not the way of Sophia. It's God's grace. And so Paul lays all of that out. Here are these two sorts of competing views, worldviews, or competing paradigms for doing life. And they're living in the midst of them. And he says, no, it's not. It's not the wisdom of the world, but it's the wisdom of God. It's not Sophia, it's Haris. Noting here that Sophia encapsulates far more than a combination of six letters in a word, right? In fact, I've said before, it's more than just a word. And again, Sophia, it goes all the way back to the 5th century, and we can think of Socrates, and we can think of Plato and Aristotle back in the 5th and 4th centuries. But we can go all the way back to ancient Greece, all the way back to the ancient Greek city-state of Athens, which was really the birthplace of sophism and the sophist. And it's there, the sophist was A sophist was one who was an expert in a particular craft, who was considered to have expertise in a particular discipline of study. And hopefully this, again, sounds really familiar. But Paul writes, right, again, in all of our doing life together, our attitudes and actions, right, we have done so relying not on this sophistic way, but on God's grace. Right? In the midst of my relationships with all of these people. Right? And Paul speaks into that. Paul speaks into that idea that no, there's this way of doing life. And it's the way of Sophia, or it's the way of Haris. And so we can fast forward from that ancient experience where sophists were well regarded, where sophists were highly esteemed, where sophists were truly experts in a craft, where they were truly experts in a particular discipline of study. But then we go to Paul's day, we go back to the first century, we go to the ancient Greco-Roman world, we go to what was called the second sophistic, this period of second sophistic, what was an experience of a movement of an intellectual elitist movement, if you will. An intellectual elitist movement that began not so much as an expertise in any particular field, but morphed into more of a form of entertainment. And we do well to keep this in mind, because this is not, at this particular time in the first century, this is not a mindset, it is the mindset. It is the pervasive, prevalent mindset that flows all through ancient Greco-Roman culture, what author Peter May calls a major undercurrent, flowing all throughout the ancient Greco-Roman world. And not only that, I would suggest it also flowed through and into some of the ancient Jewish practice. Maybe not the same form, but even then bent toward. May continues, sophist orators were an active force in major Mediterranean cities. And we can think specifically here of Corinth. Corinth was a major city of commerce, of economics. Major Mediterranean city, centers of commerce and education in the middle of the first century. And it's into that context then that we begin to see what kind of Paul is getting after here. Noting that these people, as they were in Paul's day, right, they would travel all over these sophists would travel all over the ancient Mediterranean. They would come to cities like Corinth. Masses of crowds, we've talked about this before, masses of crowds would come out to see them. Again, for me, he says there was a sense of expectation in the crowd who looked to be entertained. No longer was this an expert in a particular field. This was a mode of entertainment. While the sophist would look for loud applause and shouts of acclamation as he basked in his own glory. From Philostratus, a.k.a. the Athenian, from the 3rd century, he's looking back, he describes the sophist this way. He says, flowery, bombastic, full of startling metaphors, too metrical, too dependent on tricks of rhetoric, too emotional, he calls it theatrical shamelessness. From a contemporary of Paul, this Alexandrian Jew, he described the sophists as imposters, flatterers, inventors of cunning plausibilities who know well how to cheat and mislead, but that only, and have no thought for honest truth. Dio Chrysostom, I've shared this before, because he is speaking directly to those in Corinth. And he writes, that was the time when one could hear crowds of wretched sophists around Poseidon's temple, shouting and reviling one another. Their disciples, as they were called, fighting with one another. Many writers, I love this part, many writers reading aloud their stupid works. Many poets reciting their poems while others applauded. And peddlers, not a few, peddling whatever they happened to have. And with that, then relationships really became centered on conflict, centered on rivalry, centered on what Ben Witherington calls one-upmanship, and really what amounts to a form of self-promotion, the elevating of self over another, the elevating of self over one over another, devaluing. Paul, like Isocrates and Cicero, is concerned to oppose sophistic rhetoric that makes oratory an end in itself. And again, we need to keep in mind that this, beginning from the 5th century BC, vastly different, but when you come into the 1st century, it's a completely different ballgame. It's a completely different sort of cultural reality. And this is what Paul is speaking into, and this is what he's pushing back against. This is the challenge that he's having. And so keep in mind that that is absolutely the climate of which Paul is writing into, and when we read his words, that's what he's pushing back against. Keeping in mind, not only is that true for Paul, but it's true for followers of Jesus, who have been just as enamored, just as captivated by this world by the second sophist, or the second sophistic movement. They've been just as enamored and enraptured by that reality, at least as much as the rest of the Corinthian population. And Paul here, he says, no, in everything, in all of my relationships with you, and not just with you, but all over the world, but yes, right here and right now, in my relationships with you, no, it's not the way of Sophia. It is not to be the way of Sophia, it's to go the way of grace. Right? It's not the way of the sophistic movement, it's not the way of worldly wisdom. It's the way of God's grace, it's the way of Hotries. What Bible scholar Spyros Zodiates, I love that, described as the absolutely free expression of the loving kindness of God. You might remember that when we were in Galatians. The absolutely free expression of the loving kindness of God. What late pastor and author A.W. Tozer, he says, is the good pleasure of God that inclines him to bestow benefits on the undeserving. And so like it is for Sophia and Grace, right? It is a way of being in the world. It's a way of doing life and being in relationships together. Noting this way of grace, incidentally, this way of grace is intimately connected with the cross. If we were to jump back for just a moment to 1 Corinthians, 1 Corinthians in chapter 1, verse 17, Paul there says explicitly the reason that he has been sent. Right, the heart of his relationship with others, with the other, with all others, the heart of his relationships with everyone, with all others, he says, is centered in the cross. Not with Sophia, not in the midst of the sophistic movement, right? Not with all of its eloquence, right? Not with Sophia and her eloquence, lest the cross of Christ, he says, be emptied of its power. Point being, again, this way of grace, it goes the way of the cross. What is not as was true for the sophists, a way of elevating self, a way of promoting self, a way of seeking fame and glory for self. But as Jesus tells us, Matthew 18 and 24, Mark 8 and 34, Luke 9 and 23, the same story is told. Jesus himself tells us, no, it's not elevating self, it's deny self. Right? Whoever wants to be my disciple, we could say whoever wants to walk in this way of grace, must not elevate themselves, and we can think here of arrogance and self-importance, but rather, he says, deny themselves, take up their cross daily, and follow me. And in short, here Paul in verse 12, and in 1 Corinthians verse 17, he follows the pattern of Jesus, right? Who records here in Luke, right, that there are two manners of doing life. There are two paradigms, there are two models, there are two examples, right, for life and relationships. And there's this way of sophism. There's this way that goes the path of Sophia, that goes the way of one-upmanship, that goes the way of rivalry, goes the way of status, and it goes the way of elevating some and devaluing others. There's that way of sophism, where self is at the center. What Paul in Galatians says is a self-centered, ego-oriented, seeking after what is good for me way of life. And there is that way of the cross, the way of grace, that puts God at the center. What Paul in Galatians says is a God-centered, other-oriented, seeking after what is good for the whole, the total, for all way of life. Whoever wants to be my disciple, right? Whoever wants to live this manner of grace with me at the center, he says, must deny themselves, take up their cross daily. And then he says, follow me. Must deny is one word in the Greek. Can be translated to deny or to renounce. It has this idea of claim no relationship to. It's to echo Jesus' prayer that night that he was in so much anguish. When he says, God, not what I will, God, but what you will. It's to echo Paul, the words of Paul when he says, I no longer live, but Christ lives in me. To deny oneself, it's this idea to think and to move and to study and to play and to do life, to do relationships with God at the center. With God at the center. Which invites us to consider, what manner of life am I embracing? What manner of life, what way of life am I embracing? When I head out the door in the morning, when I have that conversation with that other, when I go outside and see my neighbor, what manner of life am I living in that moment? What manner of life am I living in all my moments? Is it the way of the sophistic movement, or is it the movement of grace? Is it the way of power and control, or is it the way of releasing and letting go? In essence, is it life with self at the center, or is it life with God at the center? Probably, if I'm really honest, the answer is yes. Right? Is it life with self at the center, or life with God at the center? Well, yes. Right, when you're home, when you're at work, when you're at the store, when you're driving, when you're seeking forms of entertainment, when you're in the midst of that conflict, that confusion, when that difference is becoming a disagreement, when that disagreement is becoming a division, living this way of grace, Jesus says, goes the way first of deny yourself. Deny thyself. We begin by putting God, not self, at the center. Whoever would walk in the path of grace, first Jesus says, must deny themselves. And then it says, take up their cross, iro in the Greek, meaning to carry or to lift. As Witherington puts it, this would not have sounded like a flowery metaphor. You know, I have a chain with a cross around my neck. I remember some time back somebody asked me, why do you wear that? And I have to confess, in some respects, I think it's a nice piece of jewelry. In another sense, it can remind me of my relationship with God, with Christ. But there's an element of it that I recognized, right? That it would have not sounded like a flowery metaphor to first century persons. Rather, it would be seen as an invitation to come and die. The exhortation means that the disciple gives up her right to her own life up front. She would be affirming a willingness to give her all, even her very life. Right? Meaning we die. We die to our own manner of living. We die to our own control, to our own desires to be in control. We maybe die to outcomes. Maybe we die to our sophist tendencies to put self at the center. Right? Maybe it means dying to an appetite for wealth. Maybe it means dying to a love for comfort and ease. Maybe it means dying to the status, to the desire for status and honor. In what way is God bidding you to come and die? In what way is God bidding you to come and die? We could ask it this way: in what way are you being invited to surrender? To sacrifice and surrender, right? Maybe pride or complacency or greed, status, needing to always be right. Maybe it's power. Maybe it's control. Oftentimes these things have a lot to do with control. Oftentimes we want to control outcomes. In what way is God bidding you to come and die? Must deny themselves, take up their cross. And then we read, and follow me, akoletheo, meaning to follow or to get behind. Right? Meaning we are to follow the way that Jesus has chosen. Right? It's not Jesus, come bless my life. It's like, no. My life, how does my life bless God? Right, oftentimes we have this idea of if I want to get more of God into my life. But this is saying, no, get more of your life into God. To follow God, to go behind. Right, to walk as he walked. To live as he lived. The Apostle John writes, anyone who claims to be intimate with God and think you're a follower of Jesus ought to live the same kind of life Jesus lived. And I think this is really, I mean, it should feel like it gets pretty tough, because following Jesus is not easy. Just ask the rich man who was told to sell all he had. But I think we need to ask ourselves, then, what gets in the way of our following Jesus? What gets in the way of my following Jesus? What do I need to let go of, or maybe what do I need to surrender, that I might follow him more closely? Paul writes here what I think Jesus invites. There's this way, right, of Sophia, this way of worldly wisdom, the sophistic movement, where relationships center on what the scholar Ben Witherington calls one-upmanship, where there's fighting and rivalry and elevating and devaluing and self-promotion, glorifying self. And there's this way of grace, haris, that travels the path of the cross, right? Deny yourself, take up your cross, and follow me. And Paul writes, now this is our boast. Our conscience testifies that we have conducted ourselves in the world, and especially in our relations with you, with integrity and godly sincerity. We have done so relying not on worldly wisdom, but on God's grace. Let's pray. God, we thank you for this word to us. It is not an easy word. The way of sophism continues to be a powerful force, even today, perhaps in a different form, but yet it still has a power in our culture, in our world today. And Lord, you invite us to step away from that and to seek after you, to go the way of haris, to go the way of your grace, and in doing so, to deny ourselves, to take up our cross, and to come follow. As we go into this day, into this week, God, I pray that that would be true for each one. You would mold us, shape us, make us, convict us, encourage us. And now as we sit in a time of stillness, Lord, would you continue to speak to our hearts and our minds And to the extent that you would invite us to share with one another, Lord, may we be faithful to do that as you prompt us. We thank you for the gift it is to gather together and to lean into your word and to worship and praise you. And we continue that now in silence and stillness. This we pray in Jesus' name.